Welcome, everybody, to the Local Hour. It's the David Samson Show, as it usually is on Thursdays. Lots of interesting contracts being handed out in Major League Baseball. I do want to talk to you about the transactions going on, but I want to lead with an NBA transaction that was pretty fascinating. I was led to believe that John Wall had one of the unmovable contracts in that sport, and now I have learned with certainty in the NBA, there is no such thing as an untradeable contract. What's your takeaway from the Russell Westbrook for John Wall and a first-round draft pick trade that just went down?
Well, first of all, I was laughing at Tommy Shepard, who works with the Wizards. The old GM was a guy named Ernie Grunfeld, by the way, who taught me how to shoot free throws when I was a little boy. He was a Jewish player from married a Milwaukee, Wisconsin girl. And so I knew him because I was a Milwaukee guy. So I've known Ernie Grunfeld forever. And what Tommy Shepard said, I don't know why, we could talk about Ernie for a whole show because there's some great stories. Do you know what the Bernie and Ernie show is, by the way, either of you? Mike, do you know Bernie and Ernie?
No.
Can we not talk about Ernie Grunfeld for a great deal of time? I feel like during my sports career, I spent too much time talking about and thinking about former Knicks GM Ernie Grunfeld.
So I view him as a player, actually, as part of the Bernie Ernie show. But anyway, Tommy Shepard of the Wizards said, hey, John Wall is not going to be traded. And the minute I read that, I went on to nothing personal, and I made that a full topic because you don't ever say that about a player. You say everybody could be traded, but some are less likely to be traded than others. The reason John Wall was not likely to be traded, he's coming off a ruptured Achilles, he's been hurt, and he's overpaid by so much. So what do you do in sports when you have that is you go around the league when your owner tells you to get rid of this guy, and you look for another guy that another team has been told by its owner that it has to get rid of. So the Westbrook-Wall trade is actually a trade from heaven because it's two teams who wanted to get rid of two overpaid players who have not helped their teams win at all at any time. So what it shows you is that anytime you sign a player, and I would say this to the owner all the time, we'll sign him. Don't worry. We'll be able to trade him no matter what. Even if we have to pay a little bit of the contract down, we'll be able to find somebody who thinks they can do better than we did with that player. And that's what happened in the NBA. And as Pablo so perfectly put last night, there is no such thing as an untradeable contract, whether it's basketball or baseball. But these two guys stink, Mikey. Both of them.
I do have to sort of...
Stink is too strong.
Yeah,
saying never help their team win is also too strong.
Russell Westbrook was an all-star this year.
An MVP.
Well, and John Wall helped his team win. But if you want to look at it right now, I understand their stock is low, especially considering what most people just sort of naturally project Russell Westbrook's game to be. These are two players that had tremendous athleticism and relied on it. But Russell Westbrook was an all-star this year on merit for Houston, David.
Right. So I we don't focus when you're running a team. That's a very fan thing to say, right? You look at whether he's an all-star. You look at how many points per game he scores. I'm talking about what happens when he joins a team and whether or not that team gets better. That's how you evaluate players. And I do not view the Rockets as a better team. You can blame D'Antoni if you want. You can blame the offensive system if you want, but they simply weren't better. And the Wizards, I don't understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
The Wizards, what have they ever won?
Well,
ever.
You sort of checkmated me here because I agree with you, but I need to present the other side. There are plenty of rational human beings that would point to, wait, he wasn't voted in by the fans. This was a merit-based argument in a sport that it's really difficult to actually make the All-Star team. There's several great players. Like Mike Conley Jr. has never made an All-Star team. It's hard to make the NBA All-Star game based off of merit and not fan vote, and they did.
It's not
but
saying
when you're
much.
A team, you don't care about that. You don't care about guys who make your All-Star team, except it's fun for the All-Star poster. But other than that, when players make All-Star teams, you just have to pay them more in bonuses, and it doesn't give your team one more victory.
In fairness to John Wall, though, when he was healthy, the Wizards, this isn't saying much. It's grading on a curve, David, but the Wizards had their highest seeded playoff teams ever. Like, that's a bad franchise for a long time.
I think they were a game away from the Eastern Conference Finals.
And they were a 4 or 5 seed. I know it's middling, but it's not irrelevant. Like, it's not both players stink.
But this is a player that relied on athleticism, that was one of the fastest players in the NBA, and he had an Achilles injury. That's a big injury. So they had to staple the first-round draft pick. But it's weird. Unlike Major League Baseball, bad contracts have a tremendous value. Like the Miami Heat sign Myers Leonard to a deal that really upset every Heat fan because they didn't think he was worth it.
$9 million a year, two years, right?
But there's a bizarro thing in the NBA. Now, I know that there's like a no-trade thing caked into at least part of his deal, but bad contracts in the NBA, because it's a cap sport, have a value because the salaries need to match up.
So that's exactly what the point is, though. So you cannot then evaluate a trade. You have to do it based on money. This was a complete money. It's not, there's no money dumps, right, in basketball, because you have to match up salaries. There can be year dumps where you are gaining years and you're gaining flexibility in future years on your cap. Unlike baseball, where you can just do a straight money dump, and I used to love those because
that was your favorite. That was your favorite. I would say,
how could it not be?
Do you object to the appraisal? You're the king of the money dump.
I wouldn't say I'm the king, but I'm certainly the prince. I don't want to say I'm the king, and because in order to be the king of the money dump, you have to demand the money dump. That makes you the king. The prince of the money dump gets to do the dumping. So I'd always rather do the dumping.
There's a lot of interesting contracts being handed out in Major League Baseball. Is this everyone just sort of in a holding pattern because of the pandemic? Because I'm seeing a lot of one-year deals right now, David.
Well, you're seeing that from players. Yesterday, last night, was called the non-tender deadline. That's the deadline by which a team has to offer a player a contract who is eligible for arbitration, because if they don't, that player becomes an unrestricted free agent. Now, let's take a look at the Chicago Cubs, because I think we're being informed now as to why Theo left. Theo Epstein left the Cubs because he saw this cut in payroll. He saw players getting non-tendered. He saw his employees getting fired around him and or furloughed or whatever the case may be. I don't buy any of that is the reason why Theo left. But all of that said, the Cubs have their window. Remember the Cubs dynasty that was being built? Is it a dynasty when you win as many World Series as the Marlins? Wait, I'm wrong. Fewer World Series than the Marlins did over a six-year period. Is it a dynasty that Theo built with the Cubs?
No, not at all.
Not at all. And remember when they were winning in 15-16, the thought was this is the dynasty with Bryant and Baez and Schwarber. Remember, Schwarber was so amazing. He's, by the way, he's a free agent right now, and someone's going to sign him because an owner right now is saying, hey, this is a home run league. I love home runs. Let's get Schwarber in, pay him $5 million with incentives to get him back to what he would have gotten had he gone through arbitration, and let him mash for us. But they haven't lived with Schwarber and realized he's a defensive liability and that he hits 200.
He's a keg softball player.
That's right, but he's a millionaire doing it.
Yeah.
So that makes him quite a few steps above a keg softball player.
He also looks like he fronts a new metal band from the early 2000s a little bit. I mean, who rocks the chin strap right now?
So he's the type who, if he were playing football, right, would he have the face mask, the one bar across, the Mark Mosley face mask? Do you remember Mark Mosley?
No, he's the type of football player that
would have. Mark Mosley was an MVP. We talked about this the other day, that he somehow won MVP of the league, the scab season.
He's the type of football player that'll have two cans of beer attached to his football helmet, not the single bar.
You talked about Mark Mosley like within the last 5 days.
We do this all the time, David. We get nostalgic and old around here. What? It might not be last 5 days. How long ago was it, Mike? What, 10 days ago?
We talked about Mark Mosley. We talked about the kicker that won MVP in the NFL.
That's Mark Mosley.
Yeah, Mark Mosley. Mark Mosley.
Yeah, we talked about him like, I want to say 3 weeks ago.
Okay, so three weeks ago.
That makes me laugh because I haven't thought about that name in probably 2 decades.
Well, we haven't thought about it in 3.5 weeks. Yeah, that's just how we get down here. Talking to David Sampson, host of Nothing Personal. You know that by now, I'm sure. And all right, David, I've had this filed away. All right, this is my ripcord. Let's talk about the Balco congressional hearings.
Whoa, we're getting to that after all this time. We are finally getting. Do you have any notes on that, David? Where are the notes on the congressional hearing? Do you have any notes on that?
Not in my current location, but they're certainly in my brain. That was a very interesting time in baseball. But I thought you were going to start to talk to me about steroids and our players.
Well, I have talked to you. There. I've talked to you about Pudge. Obviously, and we had some fun conversations about that. But what I've learned in talking about you is like you don't want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. You are a necessary. I hate to paint you this way, but evil in Major League Baseball. You described how influential you were in getting commissioners elected. I was sort of stunned at how much say you had in that, because the impression that I got from you was because of the revenue sharing that other Major League Baseball owners didn't really like you and your team. However, you seem to be necessary. So I'm wondering how much influence and say you had over the steroid controversy that's
around. I feel like David is the human cartoon manifestation of this is how sports business has to be cold and conducted.
You need some David Samsons, but I am reading the room right now, and I think you might be taking exception to some of the things I'm saying and painting it. So please,
Evil's a little strong.
Well, I said I didn't want to frame it that way.
Not unnecessary. As strong as John Wall and Russell Westbrook suck, but Evil is pretty strong for David.
One of the verbal foibles that you have, Mikey, that is interesting to me as we've been doing these local hours, is you try to preface something and you caveat it and then you say it anyway. So what yes. that means actually when people are listening to this is that's really what you think.
It's like the phrase
to be honest.
Yeah.
And then you go on and talk, which is such a joke. You never should say that because it means all the other time you're talking and you don't qualify. You're not being honest.
No offense, but I'm going to offend you.
No offense, but this doesn't need to be said, but well, then don't say it. I think that you throw around words. And my problem with you, Mike, is that you throw around adjectives that people who are listening, and you've built such a huge audience, and they believe that you choose your words carefully because that's what they want to believe. When you say something, they then believe it to be true. So when you throw around, we're like evil, of course, I'm giving a look right here off camera because that's not the case. To me, to be evil, I'm not a sociopath, number one. And the calculating that I used to do before making moves while running the team was not based on the difference between good and evil. It was based on the reality of profit versus loss. Well, and those are not
But you cut through it, though. Yeah. But, Dave, one of the reasons that I like talking to you, one of the reasons that we enjoy the content farm that you are, is because you have a way of just cutting through the bullshit in a way that's cold and surgical. And people don't do that with their mythology. Like, even as they say sports is a business, like, they get appalled by how bare and naked the greed is right now when you're seeing a football game in the NFL at 3:45 in the afternoon and baseball playing this lopsided, ridiculous, distorted season to pin a champion.
Right, but that's not evil.
But in sports, when you're the mythology buster with cash, that it's the worst thing. Like, the greatest divide in sports to me between the fan and the player is that gulf of you don't have to work for your money the way that I do. It's money. It's the biggest gulf between the customer and what he's consuming, he or she is consuming.
Do you view that in the other areas in which you do business? When you're on a flight, do you view yourself as having a huge gulf between the people who are running the airline and you who are using it as a customer and flying it?
Well, yeah, because they're sitting in the back and I'm in the front.
I don't want to get bogged down here. Let me just apologize to you for calling you evil, but also, audience, you know exactly what I meant and what I was speaking for there. So
again, you caveat it like that.
No offense.
Right. I am sorry for calling you evil. The audience knows what I meant by that. Let's move on.
Okay.
All right.
What was your question?
How much influence?
Do you have a soul?
Yeah. On a scale from 1 to 10, exactly how evil are you? So you had this power that was very surprising to me just because of how you were perceived in the media. Okay, are we all in agreement of the language that I just used?
Evil is strong, but evil would be
I was surprised that the owners leaned on you so heavily because the impression that I got was that you were just stealing their money via revenue sharing and you were a thorn in their side.
Okay. So let me tell you how steroids worked, because I think that you're confusing steroids with the other inner workings of baseball. Steroids were something that when I got into baseball, it was full-fledged. Everyone was taking steroids and everyone. That's a bit of hyperbole. So very many, a majority of players were taking some sort of performance-enhancing supplements or drugs. And it was so out in the open because it was in the clubhouses. It was not being distributed by the team when I first got to Montreal. We did not actually, you don't go to the training room and then we give you drugs. What we did is we basically turned our back. when we saw what the players were doing, as long as the players were getting the results.
Actively, you saw it. Like, is there a time you remember seeing something and saying, I shouldn't be seeing that, never mind?
No, because I would never look at it that way. So by definition, if you listen carefully to what you said, that would assume that when I was looking at it, I would know it to be so wrong that I want to turn my back on a violation so I can have plausible deniability. I didn't even think in those terms back then because I didn't need plausible deniability because I was in a ship with 30 other captains, all of whom were doing the same thing, except everyone was lying about it. So the thing about steroids that always interested me is that it only became a thing when the PR got so bad that baseball was forced into under Bud Selig to address it. Because the union knew about it, the owners knew about it, the players, the executives, the GMs. When you were signing players, it was one of the questions. This is sort of pre-analytics in a way. You thought to yourself, okay, this player who we're about to sign, does he take steroids? And if so, will he want to continue to take them once we sign him? Or are we not getting who we're paying for because he's going to take the money and then decide he wants to stop doing the protocol? Does he want to get his wife pregnant? Is he getting hurt more? So those are the types of things we were looking at with signings as opposed to some of the other factors like war or launch angle, which have now become so prevalent.
It's funny. It was just as plain as day. It was a part of your evaluation when looking to acquire talent. Is he on steroids right now? How would you vet that? You would just look at his bicep size?
You would just look at Dan Uggla.
You would just look at him.
You would just stare at him. And then you'd be like, yeah.
So Dan Uggla is an interesting one. And anyway, I don't think that is necessary to go that way, but we certainly can.
Well, don't leave there. Don't leave. Hold on. You had something for us that might be a little bit interesting there.
So he is my first introduction to Dan Uggla was as a rule. He was a pickup back in 06 when we had traded away all the players from the 05 team trying to
got him for nothing.
03.
You got him for nothing. One of the great steals in the history of the Rule 5 draft.
Well, so here's the funny part. It's not that he was a great steal. It's there was a difference when we had him versus when the other team didn't want him. So that is always a risk during the steroid era, that you are going to be, sometimes you're the bug and sometimes you're the windshield, right? That's just the reality. With Dan Uggla, who to this day is one in the top five of the players who I'm close to and actually friends with, and we do communicate, and we talk about the money he made, both with the Marlins and with the Braves, because he is set for life. I'm a little bored now, maybe, but set for life.
He must laugh about it. He must laugh about it with you because of the fight of the $50 million contract where you guys were offering something. I don't even remember the details, but he knew he was going to get more years. He knew he was going to get his money somewhere, and he did.
Well, that's a totally different story where he was just honest with me. He told me what Atlanta was offering, and I told him that we didn't have the money to get to that. And we sort of had a tear and then a laugh, and we said, good luck in Atlanta. And
David,
get the extension.
If I may, were you doing sort of some of the older evaluation? Because Dan Uggla is like one of these guys that many people just assume by looking at the size of his forearms that there's not a lot of precedent for. Well, in that sport there is, but it's rare for a guy to be Rule 5, not this highly touted guy, burst onto the scene and be one of the historic power hitters at his position. Were you applying some of that? Well, I don't know for sure if he's doing this, but there seems, look at his forearms. There seems to be a drop off coming here.
I don't know for sure.
I'm trying to protect David.
It's hard to look and not know for sure, right? It's just hard. I mean, you learn what to look for. You learn for body changes. You learn to look for acne. You learn to look for mood swings. You learn to look for behaviors. So it's really not that difficult. It's the same way. It's funny you're mentioning this because when people talk now about character, you want certain characters in your clubhouse. You want to make sure that this is not going to be a quote unquote, it's a horrible expression. I hate that we used it, but cancer in the clubhouse, you don't want those things. And when you've got steroid guys, you are in danger. You're walking perilously close to that being in your clubhouse. I've heard stories, you know, about the Orioles back in the day, you know, with David Segui, let's say, and Brady Anderson. Yeah. Brady Anderson is the example I want to bring up. He did steroids because he wanted to get paid, and then he didn't want to keep doing them. So he did steroids, got paid, stopped doing steroids, and went back to being Brady Anderson. And back in those days, owners were so enthralled with the possibility of having someone signed who was doing steroids, who would continue to do steroids, that the biggest differentiating factor in evaluating talent was in deciding whether or not that player would continue to take them. That became a difference maker between a good signing and a bad signing.
I kind of want to stay here and maybe do a larger overarching Balco congressional hearing episode, because there's a lot of avenues I want to follow right now. I do find it funny that your steroid task force was basically what it is to us sitting at home. Well, look at the size of this guy.
Look at his head.
Wait a second. This guy looks surprisingly jacked.
So we would speak to players and speak to agents. What agents would try to tell us, and there were a bunch of agents who were really funny about this. Hey, listen, my guy works so hard this offseason. He is ready to take the next step in his career. And he spent the entire offseason working on his body. He was doing 3-a-days. And I would just laugh, because in baseball, the offseason is basically October, if you don't make the playoffs, November, December, January, and then you go to spring training in February. So it's not like you have an off year. An off season is a year. It's a third of a year. And I've not been able to ever meet a player who can transform his body during an off season other than starting to take steroids or stopping to take steroids. But the other little nugget about steroids, it's not just about the biceps. That's not accurate. It's about injury and avoiding injury and recovering from injury. When you go back and look at the Andy Pettits of the world, the D. Gordons of the world, they were trying to either get better faster, or they were trying to stay on the field and not have aches and pains. The reason why players do steroids was the same reason why they all did amphetamines. It is much harder than football. And I get added at all the time for this. Being a football player is way easier than being a baseball player.
The travel, baseball, the hours you're putting in, the every day of it. Like, baseball's brutal. A game 140 if you're a catcher who's just gone through a summer in Arlington, like, it's brutal.
It's the worst. It's so bad. And we watch these players physically, and we see what happens to them. For example, when we had players gaining weight during a season at Pro Player, we knew that that was an indicator that there was something going on, because you can't play in the old Marlins where the Dolphins currently play without a roof and ever gain weight, because we would weigh these guys every single week. And so we would follow their weights. And there were some players. Gabby Sanchez is a great example, who I love Gabby. He's the only player I ever came across who gained significant weight, ironically, without doing steroids, because he had had that issue in the past. So he wasn't doing them with us. And he gained weight at Pro Player.
I will say Miguel Cabrera also gained weight at Pro Player.
Not steroids. That was alcohol.
That was the booze.
Yeah. I also gained weight at Pro Player.
I think we all...
That soft serve machine. Yeah.
I think we all did. It's funny that you mention the staying on the field stuff, because Will Fuller just got hit in the NFL with a suspension for performance-enhancing drugs. And he was oddly healthy. If you followed his career, this guy was always bothered by nagging injuries. Dynamite when you could actually get him on the field, home run threat, but he could just never stay on the field. And he played 11 games this year, which seemed a little surprising. Maybe he figured something out. And then he's hit with the performance-enhancing drug thing. But you follow the corporate chain and you realize the strength and conditioning assistant coach is Brian Cushing, who, I mean, looks like a walking poster boy for performance-enhancing drugs, and he himself got hit by it by the NFL. So it carries weight, what I'm trying to say. Staying on the field is actually one of the underrated things. Oh, carries weight.
It's not underrated at all, by the way. It is, by the way, no pun intended. Staying on the field is how players get paid. It's that simple. And so, you know, Fuller, I did a full segment on him on Nothing Personal last week or whenever he tested positive, because he said something that was so ridiculous in his statement that he had met with a medical professional and he got a professional opinion about what he was taking. And he was lying, because that's not how it works in football or in basketball or in baseball. There is nothing these players take, no matter what they tell you. They know exactly what they're putting in their body. It is never a surprise, but they always pretend as though, oh my God, I had no idea that was not an approved substance. And that's a union-based PR strategy in order to elicit some sort of sympathy. And from a management standpoint, we would just laugh at that.
Dan Uglow was one of these second basemen that you could sort of kind of make your own assumptions just by looking at him. However, in the first ever guy that got hit by the steroids, well, the performance-enhancing drug violation was this guy named Alex Sanchez, and you wouldn't know by looking at him. D. Gordon, we've talked about him in the past. You look at
Guillermo Mota was like a stick figure.
Yeah, Brian Roberts, another guy that had this surrounding them, and you would look at their bodies and be like, well, I don't really see it. But with D. Gordon, He still didn't look like it, but you have to go back in the years and see that he's put on about 30 pounds, that he was actually lighter.
So D. Gordon had a body a lot like Juan Pierre in a uniform. You think that they do not have good bodies, but when you see him in the clubhouse without clothes on, that totally came off wrong, but let's just, whatever.
No,
their bodies are incredible.
That's what you saw them in the clubhouse without clothes on, and I have
D.
seen
Gordon
Juan
has
Pierre.
A
Juan
great
Pierre,
body.
Juan Pierre is actually the one guy that worked so damn hard that that body was earned. Like, there could not be any questions about steroids with that dude because everybody saw the way that guy was working.
Well, and also his arm from center field.
And by the way, he's got a great body. Juan Pierre's not in a uniform. He liked wearing baggy uniforms. That was his thing. He would always size up. There's some players, Derek Dietrich would size down. And so what happens
Uglow,
actually?
Would Uglow also size down?
Yes.
Uglow, he wanted the shirts to be, the uniform jerseys to be tight?
Yes. And so what happens is the players actually communicate with the clubhouse equipment manager. And you get to know when you acquire a player, one of the questions you ask when there's a communication is, A, what number are you going to wear? Here's the numbers that are available. But also what your size is. What do you prefer to wear? Because when you walk into the clubhouse, you have a full rack of clothes. You have workout clothes. You have batting practice clothes. You have uniforms, both home, road, and alternate. And so one of the inquiries is, all right, here's what your size is. What size do you want? And there were certain players who enjoyed Giancarlo Stanton. Did you ever notice how he does all of his post-game press availabilities?
Does he do it with his arms crossed?
He does it in a sleeveless, tight workout shirt. Take a look at back.
Oh, sexy as hell. No, what he should do is slather up in oil and just do it shirtless, emerging from a jacuzzi.
Do you remember the Sports Illustrated cover of Stanton when he was a Marlin that was body painted?
Do I? It's hanging up over here.
So it was, he signed it. I have it somewhere around here. He signed that to me, got a picture, got it framed. And he said, David, I know you would have wanted to have applied the paint yourself. Maybe next time. Love, Giancarlo. And I said to him when he gave that to me, I said, I'm sorry. I don't understand. Have I somehow given off the vibe that I want to oil your body? Like, where did
you
that miscommunication
You do give off that vibe.
Happen?
That, no, that and evil are the two vibes you give off.
David, so what about your evaluation process? You said it was pretty blunt. You would say, well, does this guy do steroids? Look at him. Is he going to fall off? Does he want to get his wife pregnant? But obviously, somewhere along the lines, it had to become a little bit more scientific than that, didn't it?
In terms of the steroid evaluation?
Because it actually became a thing that you had to deal with. It became like policy. You saw the sea change in the sport where it was something that was sort of like, we talk about it openly. Mark McGwire has a performance enhancer hanging up in his locker. It's sort of like one of these known things. So all of a sudden, like, oh, man, we have to be worried about it because we're having congressional hearings now.
So, yes. So the congressional hearings were something that people who don't remember that, that's when some of the biggest names in baseball were actually, can you imagine this is what Congress was doing? People say that there's some sort of waste going on. Now, the reason why it became such a big deal is that what was happening is that kids, the worry from Congress is that kids were going to do steroids thinking that was their best way to become a professional athlete. And steroids are just bad for you. And they're bad for you not because of the actual steroid. They actually break your body down.
Yeah, kids were absolutely doing this. You probably know from evaluating high school talent. I went to a school that had a good baseball program, and you kind of knew.
It was not hidden, right? It was not a big deal. And so one of the things we do, by the way, while drafting, before we draft a Hurricanes player, like before we draft Gabby Sanchez, we went through and talked about, okay, this is what Gabby was in college. Is there a reason to believe that that's only steroid based? And you talk to the coaches who lie. The college coaches lie on behalf of their players. You talk to the teammates. They lie. You know, Gabby Sanchez's best friend and roommate was Ryan Braun. And you go through all of those different thought processes. And you just have to, it's not scientific at all. You try to do your homework knowing that you're getting lied to by everyone who's talking to you, and you just make a decision. You're going to be wrong once in a while. We were wrong a ton about players who we thought were totally kosher and were not, or players who we thought would remain unkosher and then became kosher. So the examples of being wrong for every team. It's not just the Marlins. It was every team.
I have a couple of questions. I know you guys have talked about some of the D. Gordon stuff, but I remember thinking to myself when you guys signed him that was a poor signing, and I was wrong because he had a great season. Do you know going into that, hey, he's doing steroids. This is why his body's changed. This is why he's a little bit different as a player and a little bit better. Did you know right there with him? Because I know you guys have covered the, all the excuse making he did after he was caught doing it.
No, that's one of the biggest disappointments of my career in a long list, is the fact that D was signed to that deal and he felt the pressure to do steroids because he wanted to live up to the contract. And that is one of the great examples where I misread the room, where I didn't realize, because of his past, because of his family history, because of the pressure that he felt with that deal. Most players, when they sign a deal like that, which was completely deserved and not an overpay because of what we thought he was and would continue to be.
It's a destination for a lot of players.
So
a finish line.
Because for him, he got crazed after that. And that's what he and I talked about, that he felt as though that he had to continue to be at that level he was when he won the batting title, et cetera, et cetera. And we missed it. We absolutely missed it because I didn't think he'd be that type of player. And it's such a huge disappointment.
Do you simply assume, given that history, given that you are a realist, and given that Tom Brady and LeBron James are aging in a way that you don't normally see, do you assume that human growth hormone has now replaced throughout sports, that human growth hormone, which is much harder to trace and test, that it's just as rampant as steroids were?
There has been no change in the amount of players using PEDs. And I'll say it. And I think that people in the commissioner's office will be angry and upset, but I'll say it right now. There has been no change. They are always ahead of the testers. That is just the definition of, they are always a step ahead. It's like I view steroids the way I view counterfeit currency. The people who are good at counterfeiting are always ahead of the changes that are made to the bills, which is why there's always counterfeiting. And that's the same with PEDs.
But let me pin you down. So you have to be right. You're guessing, but you have to be right. Tom Brady, human growth hormone, PEDs.
There's no question. When you look at Tom Brady, to me, it's very simple. What you're seeing now is a sort of gnawing away of his skills as a QB, not as his ability to be on the field week after week and snap after snap. You are seeing the fact that as you get older in a position like that, it simply becomes harder for your arm to do what your brain has known your arm can do for two decades.
So you have to guess and be right. LeBron James.
So LeBron James is 36.
About to turn 36 if he's not already.
Yeah, I would not say that he has to do that yet, but it's gonna come. It's going to come. This is going to be an interesting season. If there were ever a year for LeBron James to start taking supplements, this would be it, because he wants to repeat, because he wants to catch Kobe and Jordan. And to do it in a season of 72 games with no off season, he doesn't like load management, but he's going to have to do that. If he does not sit out 8 games out of the 72 because of load management, then I would start suspecting if his minutes stay the same, because at that age, you simply cannot be on the court that much.
It's very brave of you to go out there. I care about you. You say it's going to be an interesting season. It's going to be an interesting reaction to this episode, but given your Tom Brady opinion.
You say that, but people who are in the sport are people who are knowledgeable about how HGH works. And I've spent a lot of time learning about because don't forget, my history with HGH goes back way before I was in sports. I'm 5'5". It goes back to being a child and having it being suggested by my doctor that I should have HGH. It goes back to they suggesting that my son should take HGH.
Well, that's one of the reasons it's stupid, and the way we monitor all this cheating is stupid. The idea that it would be okay for a five-year-old to help growth, but that people who are professionals and adults and are treating their body for pain endurance and for everything else.
Look at Messi. Messi had to take human growth.
It's just stupid the way we judge this stuff. It really is.
But I hope you're not confusing that I'm not judging Tom Brady in the least.
Oh, I don't I don't hear judgment.
Don't, because Tom Brady, with what I judge is I love Tom Brady's ego. Ego is what makes Tom Brady tick always. And in order to succeed at the level he succeeds, whether you are a football player or a radio host or in business or whatever you do, that drive, when you no longer have the skill to be at the level you want to be at, but there is a tool you can use to stay at that level for longer, of course you're going to do that. That's not judging.
In the history that you've had around sports, was there any denial that had you convinced maybe there's something more to this? Because if I were to highlight one, not being inside the sport that you were, but I got fooled, and I know Dan sort of got fooled by Ryan Braun.
I felt like such an idiot after that, because he just went, he pressed the gas so hard.
And he went out of his way, like if he wasn't telling the truth, he was willingly ruining the life of some poor person, some poor urine collector, and he actually did do that. While that was going on, you were skeptical the whole time, or was any part of you being like, well, if he's this aggressive about it?
I knew exactly, because of the relationship he had with someone I knew. So I knew exactly what was going on. And inside baseball, they knew what was going on. It was so pathetic what he did. And it literally changed. He could have owned Milwaukee in a way that Yelich does now, and if he stays in Milwaukee, which he will through this extension, he will become, to me, potentially the most famous Brewer of all time. Ryan Braun was the chosen one. This was before Giannis. He was the athlete in that great sports town of Milwaukee, and it's done. It's done forever, because all he had to do was say, you know what? You got me. I made a mistake. I'm sorry. I won't do it again. But he doubled down on taking out somebody. He did a Jeff Luhnow, blaming people below him who are just working for a living on something that he did and he instructed others to do, which is the lowest type. You want to talk about evil? To me, that's evil. If you are taking people who have no money, they're in no position to do anything in terms of their own sort of perceived self-worth, both financially and their lot in life, and you squash them in order to cover up what you've done, it is disgraceful. I actually got rid of all the Ryan Braun. So I had a signed ball and a bat, and Ryan Braun to me became the perfect example of someone. He and Roger Clemens ruined. We had that great moment in 03 when I gave him a standing ovation for his last pitch when he was going to retire.
It was one of the greatest moments in South Florida sports history, where the sports fans, even though we had just filled a football stadium.
We wandered over to the stadium by accident on the way to the club.
But all 70,000 plus knew exactly what was going on in that moment and respected one of the game's greats, and he took it away from us.
It was looking back on it, I remember I was on the the vomitories at Pro Player, where you walk around on the outside.
The spirals. It's not a staircase. The spiral walkways.
It's not. There's a name for it, but I'm totally blanking. I knew I was walking from the suite level down to the field level because I wanted to be down at the field level to give Clemens. I knew it was going to be his last half inning, and I wanted to make sure I was down there to give him a standing ovation, to respect what he had done. Final game. And that game was decided by an Alex Gonzalez home run. Anyway, so given the standing ovation, everything's great. And then years later, I look back and it actually still sickens me. It really does, knowing what he did after that in order to keep his career going. And then he said it was my wife's. Can you believe, how does that conversation go in bed when he says, listen, honey, here's what we're going to do. We're going to say that you're the one who's doing steroids, and that it just was addressed to me for mailing purposes, but then it was really yours, and you're the one who shot it in your own ass.
Well, I mean, if you follow Al Jazeera's reporting, it's certainly something has been used several times thereafter.
It's an excuse that has been used before. Among the most impressive things I've ever seen on a baseball field, weirdly, one of them is outfielder Kevin Mitchell making a catch in his with his bare hand over his head of a fly ball while running to, you know, catch a foul ball. And one of the others, though, not as fluky, was you mentioned Clemens. And what I think of is him brushing back Miguel Cabrera and then Miguel Cabrera going opposite field in that stadium where no one went opposite field at 20 years old. It's literally one of the most impressive things I've ever seen in baseball, where you're that witness to, holy shit, this kid is going to be good.
He didn't know who Roger Clemens was.
Amazing.
That is great. Are you kidding me? He didn't know who he was facing?
He was just a pitcher.
So he had no idea how badass that moment was.
So wait, he didn't know the standing ovation out there? Why any of that was happening?
Why is everyone celebrating this guy?
You guys are so funny. You have this version of people, of players focusing on this kind of stuff. We would have to beg the guys to come out of the clubhouse when another player was being honored, or when there was a retirement ceremony for a player, or when we signed a player to retirement, whatever the case may be. You have to go in and beg these guys to come out and respect and clap, because they just don't know. Miguel Cabrera grew up in Venezuela with not a penny to his name.
It's the Rocket.
And you're wondering whether he knows Roger Clemens?
It's the Rocket.
That's so ridiculous.
It's the Rocket.
Of course not.
Dave, I'm not some novice about things. Like, it's odd to hear.
Baseball.
It is odd to hear someone say they're facing Hall of Famer, standing ovation, 20 years in baseball, Roger Clemens. It is rare for, I know it was true of Luis Castillo and some other guys. It's still rare to not have any idea who Roger Clemens is.
Why don't you ask some people who are 20 about people in the radio or TV industry? Ask them about certain shows. They will not have heard of so many people that to you are Bob Newhart.
They
How
might
many
have
people know Bob Newhart in your industry who are coming out of college.
We talked about Fred Mertz yesterday for about 15 minutes.
This would be, if you want to draw that analogy, this would be like an aspiring teenager that wants to be a sports talk radio host that has no idea who Jim Rome is.
So
it's language and education and poverty difference. I mean, it's what Sampson is saying. Like, Miguel Cabrera might have grown up without Major League Baseball available to him in any way.
And it's not just that. What do you think? They have like satellite TVs and direct TV?
No, but I do think in the minor leagues, you learn something. Like, you spend a little time in the minor leagues, you do learn some things.
Well, our specialty was keeping people in minor leagues for such a short period of time that there's not time to learn anything. We were calling him up. Miguel Cabrera, he was 20. He was okay. I want you to find on your show today, find a sophomore in college. That's what we're talking about here. These are kids. It's funny that you guys think that he was facing Roger Clemens.
I talked to a lot of 19, 20-year-old soccer players. They know, like, some of the guys they watched growing, and they're from all sorts of
different
countries.
We don't need to argue about this anymore.
I believe him. He would know better. It's just amazing. It's the Rocket.
He shouldn't make us feel like fools for finding that funny.
No. I find it it's funny. I don't want to make you feel like a fool. The reason I don't find it funny is that Roger Clemens is not the greatest example. Let's think about the most famous Venezuelan baseball player. Mm-hmm. That is someone Miguel Cabrera knew very well about, because that's who he's trying to emulate. He's trying to get out of Venezuela. He's trying to make a career and get his family out and get money. Those are the people who are the idols, right? In the Dominican, you go back, Puerto Rican players are looking at Tony Perez. So it's very different. MLB, American white players are not the heroes of those young kids in Venezuela or the Dominican.
Makes sense. All right, David, we're wrapping up here. Let's get to your review for the week. You told us what it was going to be before we started recording. I'm very excited to hear your review of this Belushi doc.
So there's a Belushi doc on Showtime Anytime. So it just came out, and here's what it is, that I'd never seen a documentary like this. It was all based on interviews with people, many of whom are dead now, like Penny Marshall and others. Harold Ramis is very prevalent in this documentary, and he's unfortunately passed away. It is first-person accounts of John Belushi's life, and there are people who have not heard of John Belushi, by the way. There's people who don't realize that John Belushi was Chris Farley before Chris Farley was Chris Farley. And this movie for an hour and 50 minutes.
It was so artfully done, David. It was it just had a really nice sculpted touch, that movie.
What the common thread for Belushi, if you don't know anything about him and you even don't like Saturday Night Live, it's still worth it to watch because it continues the thread of recent documentaries about figures who died and who we sucked the life out of. And I'm talking about Come Inside My Mind with Robin Williams. I'm talking about a Chris Farley documentary. We suck the life out of these guys, not realizing the pain they were in, not realizing it's exactly like steroids if you want to go full circle. John Belushi does cocaine. I don't care. He makes me laugh. He entertains me. And if it's going to kill him at 33, you know what? I hope he doesn't die, but man, I love being entertained by him. We are all complicit. So I watched the movie last night feeling like crap. Feeling like I was one of the people who forced him to be a drug addict, who forced him to die alone with heroin at the Chateau Marmont. And it felt a way that I never felt before about John Belushi. I felt tremendous guilt about what I had done.
I like that the filmmakers didn't go into sort of, you know, Robin Williams gave him the blow or what that night was like or any of the stuff that was a mess, you know, a paparazzi mess. Back when this happened, because you could have made the argument for, you're talking about people in our audience who don't know from the past, like John Belushi was at the very top of whatever the entertainment ladder was. Like he was considered at the time the funniest man in America, I think.
This was big font death, right? That's how you judge it when you look to see where that is in the paper and what the font is when it happens. This is back in 82. And so it's a long time ago. So people, 30-year-olds, do not know who John Belushi is. They just don't. And so this was a what I call the big font death because it was so shocking that someone would die that way. Now, of course, you had Marilyn Monroe and some of the other people who died young, the James Dean, et cetera. But James Belushi's death started the epiphany of people that maybe these artists and entertainers have problems that we're not willing to address and don't care to address, and this is how it's going to end. That's what, by the way, when Christopher, how about Philip Seymour Hoffman? There's a long list of people who are tortured, and we ignore it because we want to be entertained.
John Belushi is what he meant there.
Yeah,
not,
you said James, who's still with us.
I meant John. Sorry.
I do wonder, though, David, because I just really liked so many parts of that movie. One of the things that struck me is how good both Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis were on the subject of death and how heartbroken Aykroyd was, without spoiling too much of the movie, at how close he was as a friend to getting to Belushi before he died and having to live with the weight of that now.
Did you go see Not Ready for Prime Time when I played Lorne Michaels?
Yes.
Did you? Okay, so that a lot of that play was based on what this movie was about and some of the things with Aykroyd and Belushi and that and their relationship that they had.
I feel like the
and
audience.
They were, forget best friends.
The audience does need some context.
Need some
here.
Context.
Like you just went so inside on our conversations that you dropped into the middle of this. The fact that a lot of people might not know that you played in a play, in a Saturday Night Live play that I attended.
Okay, well, thank you for buying a ticket. Yes, there's a play called Not Ready for Prime Time in a theater in Miami called New Theater, and I tried out for and got the part of Lorne Michaels, and it was about the start of Saturday Night Live.
Wait, you went through a tryout process?
It's an audition. How else do you get a role?
And by being David Samson? I mean, you got a role on The Three Stooges. Did you go to an audition?
No, I paid for a charity.
All right. Well, advantage Mike.
What do you mean? That was a non-speaking role.
Well, there are examples of people of influence getting roles and things. I'm just surprised Mike. That you tried out for a play as a team president of the Marlins. Why? I'm right here.
What?
It was very small. It was a small, like I remember, like it was really dedicated to the craft because it was not an easy role, and he treated it with great care.
It was 3 hours a day, 6 days a week of rehearsal. So I would work a full day, and then rehearsals would be from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. And it was 6 days a week, and it was 8 weeks of rehearsals. I loved it. I loved every minute of that experience. I think the Miami Herald did a review And I think they said that they were surprised at how much I didn't suck, though they were not willing to say that I was good.
And it was small, just so people understand sort of at the core of David, like some of the creative artist in him. Those were small gatherings. You were busting your ass, and those crowds were what, 50 people?
The theater capacity was 50. And we had every show was sold out. We did 18 performances, and they were with real actors and actresses, and I loved it. It was great.
So Marlins crowd.
Oh, nice.
I'm not proud of it.
Marlins crowd.
Are you done with the Belushi review?
I feel like I need to apologize to David Samson after this episode.
Not at all. So the end of the situation is Belushi and Aykroyd. People may view Dan Aykroyd differently. And a little nugget from Belushi that people don't talk about enough is that Ghostbusters was written for John Belushi.
Yeah, for Belushi.
And he died before he could take the
part. The role then went to Bill Murray, correct? That was the role that, yeah.
Which is ironic, right? Because Venkman, that's exactly who Bill Murray and, you know, John Belushi would be. And the tragedy of his death. But the movie's not about the tragedy of his death. The movie's about the journey, which was headed toward death from the very beginning. And the fact that people could see it. What was interesting to me is that when he took the year off for one of my favorite movies, Continental Divide, he was sober during that movie and people thought that he was cured and fine. And that's not how it goes. It's well worth seeing if you haven't seen it, Mikey.
I will check it out. Showtime anytime is a platform. Man, I got so many subscriptions right now. That one's falling by the wayside.
We're being nickeled and dimed, right?
No, there's some good stuff on Showtime right now.
All right. I'll check it out, David. Your recommendations are always good. Make sure, speaking of recommendations, let me recommend David Samson's podcast, Nothing Personal. There's nothing in it for him outside of this promotion, so I do it every week, and I implore you to check it out. It is a great podcast, and you saw with this Tom Brady opinion. He's not afraid of...
Tom Brady! Shocking! Shocking commentary!
Tough topics!
Shocking!
David Samson...
Someone is aging differently than anyone has ever aged, and David Samson has dared to guess that that person might not be doing it naturally.
The joke is that you think what makes headlines is me saying stuff that everybody else thinks, but isn't willing to say.
One last thing before you go. I was wondering if there was any fallout from the Kim Ng episode that we did. Did you hear from people in Major League Baseball? Did you hear from people in Marlins? Did you hear from Kim?
So I did have some conversations with some people in the commissioner's office about that. And it was one of those things where the preference would be not to say things that everybody knows is true. And my response was, I have no interest in being that because I'm not trying to get back into baseball. And that's why Nothing Personal works, and I'm not going to stop.
Any blowback on saying that Theo Epstein is on a commissioner track, that he wants to be the commissioner of the sport? Any feedback on that?
So you don't get blowback when everybody on the inside knows and feels the same thing. So again, you're wondering whether I get blowback with things I say. You wouldn't get blowback on the topic or the subject. You'd get blowback people saying, man, David, really? And I said, really?
David, thank you so much for joining us.